It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. The director of U.S. intelligence, Mike Pompeo, told broadcast interviewers Sunday he would not be surprised if North Korea tests another missile, downplaying the possibility of an imminent military confrontation. Meantime, the White House National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, insisted while the U.S. is prepared for a military action against North Korea, the Trump administration is trying every diplomatic means to resolve their issues. McMaster did allude to the U.S. being closer to war than a decade ago. We asked Harry Casanias, director of the Defense Studies at the Center for National Interest, what McMaster meant, and he said McMaster is simply referring to tensions being on the rise with Pyongyang.
I think what really struck everybody last week when the Washington Post report came out, essentially detailing that the North Koreans were much further along than anybody had thought, specifically being able to miniaturize nuclear weapons and put them on missiles. Essentially, what we're going through is another like Sputnik moment, I guess, if you will. 60 years ago, actually, this coming October, is when the Soviet Union put a long-range missile into the air and put a satellite above everybody's heads. And that freaked the American people out. We're basically going through a mini version of the same thing.
President Trump said the Chinese president and he and Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed that North Korea must stop its provocative behavior. They spoke over the weekend, and they also repeated a mutual commitment to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. Suspected Islamist extremists opened fire at a restaurant. It happened late Sunday in the capital, Burkina Faso, killing 17 in the second such attack on a restaurant popular with foreigners in the last 2 years. This is VOA News. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence said Sunday while Venezuela is on the path toward dictatorship, a peaceful solution to months of unrest and political turmoil is possible. He was speaking in Colombia at the start of a four-nation Latin American trip. On Friday, President Trump said the U.S. would not rule out a military option in Venezuela, a remark Rice University Latin American scholar Mark Jones described as unhelpful.
The United States has no realistic plan nor desire to get involved in an internal conflict in Venezuela. And all the president has done there is create sympathy for President Maduro in Venezuela.
CIA Director Mike Pompeo said the president was trying to give the Venezuelan people hope in creating an opportunity for a restoration of democracy. U.S. authorities are investigating Saturday's clashes in the city of Charlottesville, Virginia, between white supremacists and counter-protesters that left 3 dead and several others injured. H.R. McMaster, the White House National Security Advisor, defended President Trump's statement on the violence.
We cannot tolerate this kind of bigotry, this kind of hatred. And what he did is he called on all Americans to take a firm stand against it.
Mr. Trump Saturday said he condemned many sides in the protest over the proposed removal of a monument to a Civil War Confederate general. A civil rights investigation is underway after a woman was killed by a man who rammed a vehicle into the crowd. 2 Virginia State policemen were killed as well after their helicopter crashed while monitoring the protest. 2 aid groups have suspended migrant rescue efforts in the Mediterranean after expressing concern about threats by the Libyan Coast Guard. Save the Children and Germany's CI have joined Doctors Without Borders in halting operations to save thousands of migrants trying to reach Europe. Meantime, Italy is investigating an Eritrean priest, Masi Zarai, a human rights activist, for allegedly alerting NGO rescue ships about migrant vessels trying to reach Europe. Rome-based reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with VOA about Zarai.
He has reacted very strongly to these allegations. He says he's always acted with legality and he's the victim of a witch hunt. He says he has nothing to hide and he's always acted within the law. As a priest, he's been involved in sending SOS signals to ships. Zarai says that he's always acted appropriately. He has sent SOS signals to ships, but only through the correct channels.
Father Zarai accused of violating Italy's new code of conduct that prohibits NGOs from receiving such information on grounds that it actually helps people smugglers.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today's Monday, August the 14th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. Kenya's opposition leader Raila Odinga made an appearance in Nairobi to apologize to his supporters about losing the recently concluded elections.
He says, "We've come here to say sorry, sorry, sorry for what happened here yesterday and the other day."
Kenya's opposition leader Raila Odinga speaking to supporters in Nairobi. Mr. Odinga, who says that last week's general election results were rigged, called on his supporters to boycott work today. And in Mali, with the recent news that UN forces have found two mass graves in Kidal, along with reports of torture and summary executions, human rights bodies and other non-governmental organizations are concerned about the deteriorating security situation.
There have been allegations of abuses, killings of civilians, not only in Kidal, but also in Minaka, as well as in the Mopti regions in Mali.
Corinne Dufka with the Human Rights Watch. And a former Somali insurgent leader, Mokhtar Robo Abu Mansur, has defected to the government side. Those stories and more are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Kenya's opposition leader Raila Odinga made an appearance in Nairobi's Kibera slum on Sunday to apologize to his supporters about losing the recently concluded elections, telling his supporters sorry for the post-election death, for which he accuses government security forces, and again arguing that the newly re-elected ruling party intended to steal their victory. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Near a railway track in Nairobi's Kibera slum, at least 1,000 supporters gathered Sunday afternoon to hear remarks from Kenya's opposition leader Raila Odinga, who recently lost the hotly contested presidential race to incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta. But Odinga and his NASA coalition members say that the election was stolen from them and reiterated that position to the enthusiastic crowd. He says, "We've come here to say sorry, sorry, sorry for what happened here yesterday and the other day. They want to steal our victory, and again they come to kill our people. That is what is called impunity in English." Kenya's presidential spokesman, Manoah Esipisu, disputes these claims.
The president won this election fair and square. Both international and local observers have attested to that point. Very, really varied voices, right from John Kerry from the U.S. to President Mbeki in South Africa, all saying that the process was fair. And so at this point, there isn't really much more to say beyond that fact. And I think it's we are a democratic country. We have a democratic tradition. Obviously, there is a legal process that we encourage everyone to follow should they be aggrieved.
The Kenya National Commission on Human Rights released a statement Saturday that 24 people had lost their lives since the day after the August 7th election, and that they were a result of police using live bullets in opposition strongholds, like some Nairobi slums and areas of western Kenya like Kisumu, Homa Bay, Migori, and Siaya. Although it does not release casualty figures, the Kenya Red Cross stated that as of Sunday morning, it had responded to 117 people with various injuries since August 8th. Kenya's acting cabinet secretary for the interior, Fred Matiang'i, told Kenyans Saturday that the police always act according to the law.
But individuals or gangs that are looting shops, that want to endanger lives, that are breaking into people's businesses, those are not demonstrators. They are criminals. And you expect the police to deal with criminals how criminals should be dealt with.
The opposition holds a different view. He says they spilled the blood of innocent people. They'll pay for the blood that they spilled. NASA coalition member and CIA Senator James Orengo attempted to clarify when it was his turn at the microphone.
All we want is justice. We want peace, but we want peace with justice.
The opposition has urged supporters to not go to work on Monday and wait until Tuesday for further directions. They also blamed some local news outlets for not telling the truth and urged a boycott of certain newspapers and television stations. Celebrations and protests erupted Friday night after Electoral Commission Chairman Wafula Chebukati announced that Uhuru Kenyatta had won the election with 54.27% of the vote, beating Odinga's 44.74%. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
And after rejecting the outcome of the recent elections in Kenya, Mr. Raila Odinga called on supporters of the party to boycott work today, Monday. Some Kenyans are worried that the refusal of Mr. Odinga to concede defeat could increase tension in the country. For reaction to Raila Odinga's call to boycott work on Monday, VOA's Peter Cloti reached Senator David Musila in the capital, Nairobi.
First of all, I sympathize with the Honorable Raila Odinga having lost his election and this not being the first one to lose. However, I think that Kenyans generally would not like to get involved in any violence. And the best I can do is to advise my brother, my friend, that he probably would consider conceding if he does not wish to pursue the legal option. Because if I was to advise, I would have asked him to pursue legal option, file a petition in the Supreme Court, and let's wait for the decision. But I do understand that he has said that that's not an option. So I do not think that the route of violence or demonstrations will bear any fruit.
Some people are expressing concern that his call for his supporters not to go to work on Monday could increase tension existing already in the country following the outcome of the elections. What are you hearing?
That call for people not to go to work could incite the population. But the general feeling of the population, particularly from my community where I come from, which was in the coalition, is that violence will not be an option, and therefore they will not support.
What is the mood in the country at the moment?
Well, people are going about their businesses. I've just come from church, and churches are packed. People have gone to worship. There is call for peace by the clergy. I'm not seeing anything in Nairobi. Nairobi is quiet. Nairobi is calm, other than those spots of you have heard about. And where I am sitting now, in fact, rely more on foreign media because we are not seeing anything much. But having said that, I still believe that this country needs peace. And I think people are tired of violence. And in my own capacity, I can just appeal to people not to be violent and also to the loser or perceived loser, if you will. But he is a loser because the body that is charged with the responsibility of determining the winner and the loser has already pronounced their position. And the only option is going to court. And therefore, the mood is such that people want the legal option rather than violence.
That was Kenya's Senator David Musila speaking to VOA's Peter Cloti. The former deputy leader of Al-Shabaab, who was recently removed from the most wanted list for terrorist suspects by the U.S. State Department, has surrendered to the government. Mukhtar Robo Abu Mansur arrived in the western town of Hudur early Sunday and was later on flown to Mogadishu. Robo's defection was welcomed by the Somali officials because he has a large number of militia followers. Analysts expect that his militia will join up with the government. Rashid Abdi of the International Crisis Group in Horn of Africa tells VOA's Somali service reporter Harun Maruf that Robo's past role within Al-Shabaab makes his defection significant.
Robo was a prominent figure within the historical core of Al-Shabaab. He was one of the founders of Al-Shabaab. And I think because of his seniority, there was a perception among certain segments of Al-Shabaab that he was the natural successor after the killing of Airo. So once government took power, I think there was a feeling within segments of Al-Shabaab that Governor was not worthy of being the leader of the organization. So there was, I think, that kind of a power struggle. And then as time went on, I think it also became clear that there were differences between Robo and Governor in terms of ideology, in terms of the role of foreign jihadis in the country. There was also, I think, a conflict or a dispute about also what was the end game, what was the goal of Al-Shabaab. And I think clearly Governor favored a more hardline globalist agenda, whereas Robo, I think, was much more, was less hardline. I think also was amenable to some form of negotiations and a political settlement.
Is his defection going to damage, weaken Al-Shabaab?
No, I don't think so, because he has not been involved with Al-Shabaab for almost 4 years now. He basically was only nominally Al-Shabaab. Technically, he's not part of Al-Shabaab. He has no logistical or operational oversight over the organization. And so I don't think there is an immediate impact on Al-Shabaab. However, I think once it becomes clear that Robo basically was able to move to the other side and his life is secure and he is being protected by law, that, I think, has the potential to incentivize defections. But that will all depend, first of all, on a good amnesty plan. And I don't think the government has a good, coherent amnesty plan. If this issue is mishandled, I think it could actually backfire. However, it has great potential as well to incentivize defections.
Final question. What's the amnesty plan lacking?
First of all, I don't think there is a published amnesty plan, and we don't know to what extent that amnesty plan is linked to also, it has legal, also, it is backed by law. And I think clearly there are many aspects of an amnesty plan, and I think clearly from our own experience as crisis group, we know that amnesty plans are actually a very potent tool for conflict resolution. If there is, many people will abandon Al-Shabaab if they know, first of all, they are secure. They will have a chance at integration, and for young people, a chance at going back to school or university. You know, those are demobilization and integration also issues which I don't think have also been clearly thought out. And unless I think we have a comprehensive national amnesty plan, these kind of piecemeal amnesties will not probably work.
Rashid Addi of the International Crisis Group in the Horn of Africa. He was speaking to VOA Somali Service reporter Harun Maruf. For more developments on this story, you can always follow Harun Maruf on Twitter. His handle is @HarunMaruf. In Mali, with the recent news that UN forces have found two mass graves in Kidal, along with reports of torture and summary executions, concerns are mounting about the country's security situation. Human Rights Watch Associate Director for West Africa, Corinne Dufka, tells VOA's Ricky Shryok that there is a serious deterioration in Mali's security amid dozens of school closures and civilians fleeing violence.
There has been a rather serious deterioration in the security situation in Mali, not only in the north, but also in central and southern Mali. We are encouraged by the United Nations trying to expose some of these abuses. There have been allegations of abuses, killings of civilians, not only in Kidal, but also in Minaka, as well as in the Mopti regions in Mali. Not to mention the profound and worrying insecurity that Malians in all of these areas are experiencing as a result of relentless banditry and insecurity. There have been dozens of school closures. Civilians have fled. There have been this year three very worrying incidents of intercommunal violence, which have left dozens of people dead. So the human rights and security situation in Mali has really seriously deteriorated this year.
The UN said they uncovered, MINUSMA uncovered at least two mass graves in the Kidal region. Do you know what is known about these mass graves?
No, I think the investigation is ongoing, and we personally have not investigated that incident. There have been allegations against a number of the armed groups, both those from the former armed groups as well as the Ghatia in particular, which is really a proxy militia group representing the government.
And something else that happened last week, kind of related but not, was the Stephen McGowan was released after being held hostage for 6 years by Al-Qaeda in Mali. Do we know why he was released, how he was released? Does this show that they are getting stronger or weaker, Al-Qaeda?
Yeah, there have been a few hostages released this year, as well as an AQAM video in July in which they showed a number of other hostages that had been taken this year and late last year. We understand from a New York Times report that a fair amount of money was paid to secure the release. I'll speak to that information, but that is typically, we understand, been the case that, you know, that AQIM have received ransoms.
The New York Times piece said 3.5 million euros had been paid. How does this help AQIM to function, getting this ransom money?
It has long been assumed that Al-Qaeda and the group under the AQ umbrella exist on the back of money obtained through these types of payments. What is clear is that this year AQIM has formed a coalition of various different armed groups. The attacks by AQIM and these groups have been increasing.
That was Corinne Dufka, Human Rights Watch Associate Director for West Africa. She was speaking to Ricky Shryock from Washington. And fighting flared in South Sudan's Upper Nile state after government forces captured a key rebel headquarters. The ongoing clashes indicate there is no end in sight to the four-year conflict. For VOA, Jason Ptinkin speaks to both sides in the war and a civilian caught in between.
South Sudan's government and rebels clashed Friday in the northeastern state of Upper Nile over control of the key town of Pagak on the Ethiopian border. Pagak had been the rebels' main base since early 2014, but the government captured the town last week after launching an offensive in early July. Rebel spokesman Lam Paul Gabriel said his side took back the town Friday after a morning attack on government troops.
At about 7, we launched an attack on government in Pagak, and we've been building from Pagak, so we have full control of Pagak since about 10 a.m.
The government's original capture of Pagak was a devastating blow for the rebels, who had controlled the border town since South Sudan's civil war started in December 2013. The fact that the rebels are still able to fight back shows the conflict is far from over. The insurgency maintains control of much of the country's rural areas, while the government holds major towns.
It's a clear sign that if we are pushed to a corner, we will also push back. They took Pagak from us, now we took it back. It's the same with any other places now.
A spokesman for government forces, Dixon Gatluak, confirmed there was fighting in Pagak, but he denied that the rebels took control of the town.
In the morning, our defensive line came under heavy fire from anti-peace elements. We actually engaged them, and after a fierce battle, our forces managed to strike back in self-defense, and we repelled them. We are still maintaining our defensive line. The claim that they are doing, that they have captured Pagak and all this.
The government's offensive on Pagak drew heavy criticism from Western nations for breaking a ceasefire declared in May by President Salva Kiir, whose forces are fighting rebels led by former Vice President Riek Machar. But Gatluak said the offensive was necessary to bring government services to the people. He said civilians had welcomed the arrival of government troops.
Civilians in Pagak have been held hostage for almost 4 years in the conflict in Iraq. It was a call for the government to be on the ground to provide the services.
But according to South Sudanese aid worker Sarah Nyanyath, who was living in Pagak, tens of thousands of civilians, including herself, fled the government's offensive into Ethiopia rather than welcoming them.
The government is lying that it is being received. They are not liberating the area. They are terrorizing the area.
It is likely that even more civilians like Nyanyath will be forced to run. Jason Patinkin for VOA News in Koboko, Uganda.
And in a developing story, we're still trying to get more information on this. Burkina Faso's communications minister, Remy Danjinu, told a news conference in the capital Ouagadougou that at least 17 people were killed and 8 wounded from an attack on a restaurant in the capital. The minister says that gunmen attacked the Aziz Istanbul restaurant late on Sunday, and security forces were deployed to try and end the attack. And now it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Samson Omali in Abuja, Nigeria, with this morning's roundup of Africa Sports. Good morning, Samson.
Good morning, Jackson. We begin with the 2017 IWAF World Championships, which ended on Sunday night with Kenya coming second behind the United States on the overall medal table with 5 gold, 2 silver and 4 bronze medals. South Africa took the third spot with 3 gold, 1 silver, 4 bronze medal. On the final night of the competition on Sunday, Asbel Kiprop failed in his bid for a fourth consecutive 1,500 meters gold medal at the World Athletics Championship, but Kenya still celebrated a dazzling 1-2 finish with new champion Elijah Manangoi leading home Timothy Cheruiyot in 3 minutes 33.61 seconds.
To become a world champion, it's not a very big, not an easy thing, you know. It's not a joke. I've trained well, up and down, so I'm really happy about it.
Olympic 5,000 meters medalist Kenya's Helen Obiri claimed her first major when she ran a tactical race to dethrone Ethiopian Almaz Ayana of the world 5,000 meters title at the Olympic Stadium in London on Sunday.
I think I'm so grateful. It means a lot for me because I've training hard. This year I was focusing to win world championships. My dream was to win, and I've done it.
In the 800 meters event, Caster Semenya won her third world title using her finishing trick to sweep past Niyonsaba, Burundi. Semenya won with a season-leading 1 minute 55.16 seconds.
Of course, this is a perfect ending. You know, we had a bronze in Tau 5, gold in 800 meters. Obviously, we're the best in the 2-lap. So we quite thrilled with the performance. We're happy with the PB. It's a national record. It's amazing, you know. It's all about hard work and dedication.
Speaking shortly after picking up her silver medal in the 800 meters event, Francine Niyonsaba of Burundi said she was excited at the opportunity to have a podium finish at the World Championships.
This medal, I think, it is a key for the Burundian. All Bruneians are very happy. I knew all Bruneians were watching me, so I'm so excited.
Away from the IWAF World Championship in London to table tennis news, where Egypt's Omar Asar has emerged the overall winner in the men's single of the Nigerian International Table Tennis Federation Challenge, which was concluded on Sunday at the Teslim Balogun Stadium in Lagos. India's Gandhi Sartak was runner-up. The Egyptian, who has won all the editions of the ITTF Challenge, carted home the cash prize of $5,000, while Gandhi got $2,300 for his effort.
This competition is very special for me. I mean, to come to Lagos, it's very special. I always prepare very well for Lagos Open. I know many people are waiting for me to perform well, so that's why I was, from day one, I was here.
In football news, Equatorial Guinea have qualified for the 2018 African Nations Championship Finals on a walkover after their opponents Gabon withdrew. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Monday, August the 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryok, as well as sports editor Samson Omali, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all a great week ahead.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.